KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
When we won in the round of 16, just to see the excitement on the players' faces, and we went to dinner as a team afterwards, and just when you put in a ton of hard work to see success in young people, it's very rewarding, and it's a lot of fun. It's really cool.
And our guest this week is Jason Box. He is the head men's tennis coach at Division III Swarthmore College. He is coming off leading the Garnet to a phenomenal season in 2026. And Jason, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, it's great to be here. First time doing one of these, so I'm looking forward to it.
So, mentioned you guys had a great run this year, go to the Elite Eight nationally. I know you had individuals who reached some high honors. Like, how much fun was this season?
Yeah, I think as you look back on it, now that we're out of it, it was a lot of fun. I think every season can be a lot of fun based on the players that you have. But when you start having some of the success that you haven't had in a while, it's new experiences for me, new experiences for the players. It just really looks like a season that is one that we haven't had, and it was just a lot of fun.
Now, you guys have won four straight Centennial Conference titles. You had gotten to the round of 16 before, but this, am I correct, this was the first time under your leadership for the Elite Eight, right?
It is. I think first time since in the Elite Eight since maybe 2006, somewhere around there, and I started in 2018. So, yeah, four years ago, we lost a really close match to MIT in the round of 32. That was our first time in the NCAA tournament in a while. First time for me at Swarthmore. And we just kind of, the group kind of vowed, hey, we're not going to lose in the round of 32 again. And our goal the next year was make the round of 16. And we did a lot of things that allowed us to do that. Made the round of 16, came up against Tufts, who we lost to this year, came up against Tufts in the round of 16 that year. And we were kind of not ready for that moment and not ready for that level. And then last year, we felt like we were ready. We hadn't had some of the top 10 wins that we wanted to. Lost to Denison in a close one, and they were the eventual national champions. And so we said, hey, we got to do this next year and get past it. And we did. We got past it and made it to the Elite Eight. In college tennis, the Elite Eight is kind of the final sight, if you will. So the round of 16, round of 32 are regional type tournaments, and then the final eight go to the last site.
How has the last 4 years specifically, winning, you are now the dominant Centennial team,
right,
having this success in the NCAA tournament, how has it changed, do you think, how the program is perceived from the outside?
So in our sport, the really strong academic schools are the ones that really attract kind of the best players typically. If you look at the teams that have won the national title, they're usually pretty strong academic schools. University of Chicago won it this year. Played Claremont, McKenna in the finals. Again, these are top universities, top colleges. So when I took over, the reputation of Swarthmore academically was out there. I mean, kids were interested in it because of the level of education. But I think the tennis wasn't quite, hey, it's a great academics, but it's not a top 10 program. So if you're looking for great academics and top 10 tennis, maybe you need to look somewhere else. And so I think with the last 4 years, as we've been rising, I think the reputation out there is, well, the academics have always been there, but now that tennis is there. So if you want top 10, if you want competing for national titles, conference titles, if you want that experience as a recruit, Swarthmore is taken much more seriously. You know, it's on probably more people's lists, or maybe it's making their final list. So that's been great for us. And it's certainly, from a scheduling standpoint, people are more willing to want to play us because we're better. And so that's been fun, too, to just play. I think we played maybe 12 matches this year that were in the top 15 teams. So we kind of played almost everyone that was good. And that's been a lot of fun, too.
Now, tennis, I think most people, their familiarity with tennis is either playing it, you know, recreationally, or watching big-time tennis, Wimbledon, stuff like that. Give me the elevator pitch for people who aren't familiar, kind of how college tennis is set up. Like, if I were to come to one of your matches, how does it work? What would I see?
We're very different than your typical professional match that you're watching on TV. I think the the most unique thing is that at college tennis, you get to be loud. I think people think of Wimbledon and kind of sit on your hands. And the difference for college tennis is that it is very fan engaging. Yeah, you still can't yell during the middle of the point, but after the point, you know, people are hooting and hollering and cheering. And so it's much more engaging. It's much more fiery. I guess the best example I would give you is think of if you watch some of those night sessions at the U.S. Open, and those are really – the fans are really engaged in that and even can sometimes impact the match. I think our crowds absolutely impact the matches at a college level. We play three doubles matches to start, and whoever wins two out of those three gets 1 point, and then there are six singles matches that follow. So it can take a while sometimes, but – it's really fun because you kind of have the sequential matches finishing and the score is kind of building up. We played a 4 point, so who can get 4 points first? And so you really start to kind of feel the energy between courts because you know, okay, that court is getting close to being for us. That court is getting close to being for the other team, and you start to kind of narrow down. Oh, I think it's going to come down to this one player. So the energy is just, I think, unmatched, especially for what people think of tennis.
During your average match, how many players do you have going at once?
Well, you'll have six players playing the three doubles matches.
Simultaneously,
right. So you've got three doubles matches. And the doubles is maybe even more intense. It's a shorter format. You're just playing to one set to six. And you're trying to win two out of three. It's doubles, so it's a little bit, you know, there's a lot more winners. There's more overheads and putaways. And so you'll see just even more energy during that time, people yelling, the players being more into it because it is such a short format. And then you put out your six singles matches after that. And that's two out of three sets. So that does, you kind of have to settle in and take a little bit. But as they're all coming to a close, you know, they're all kind of coming to a close around the same time. And you're starting to see that, starting to figure out who's going to maybe win the match for you. So in our match against Carnegie Mellon in the round of 16, you know, we played great doubles. We won the doubles point, so we're up 1-0. But, you know, we lost at number one singles. We won at number two singles. We won at number three singles. So we're up 3-1. We just need one more point. So there's three matches still playing. And we were in a really tight match at the fifth and sixth spots. We were in third sets there, so we weren't sure who was going to win those. But at number four singles, we had a freshman on that court that was in control, and it's kind of like we all need him to close this out, or it could get very nerve-wracking with those other matches going on. And he closed it out, and you know, the guys stormed the court. So it was it builds to this crescendo, whether it's the last match or the last couple matches typically.
Are the six doubles players the same as the six singles players, or do you mix and match?
They can be. It depends on the team. I think
how many do you have on to start? How many are on your roster?
We actually have 17 players
17?
On the roster.
Okay.
So we would play around 9 to 10 guys every match. The NCAA limits you. So when we actually get into like the NCAA tournament, I could only play 9 players. So you have to kind of figure out your lineup down to 9. But there were matches where we played 10. There were sometimes where maybe the team wasn't quite as competitive and we play a lot of different guys, and we would play, the max you could play is 12, obviously 6 guys in doubles, 6 guys in singles. But typically, we probably, in my time, almost always play 9.
When it comes to, like you mentioned, your number one player, number two player, stuff like that, how do you approach that? Is there a point system that you put together in practice? Is it just, you know, not just eye test? I don't want to make it that simple, but like kind of a gut combination with the talent that's available. Can you challenge, like if I'm sitting 15th and I go to you and say, coach, I feel like I've come a long way, I want to get into the rotation, are there steps that a player can take to force your hand to say, okay, maybe you are ready? Like how does that work?
Yeah, every coach probably does it a little differently. I think people are probably most familiar with a ladder system. Maybe they have that at their club where you kind of challenge the person ahead of you, and if you can beat them, you take their spot. That's not really how I do it. We definitely do play practice matches against each other. Our season's primarily in the spring, but we play a lot in the fall, and so we'll play practice matches in the fall. Then we play practice matches in January and February to help kind of figure out maybe who goes where. And then once we get into matches against other teams, you see how guys are doing and maybe move them up and down based on that. I'm taking into account what I'm seeing in practice, how you're playing on a daily basis just in practice. I'm taking even maybe previous years into account. Great example of this was our number two player, he's a senior, he'd been number two the last couple of years. I mentioned this freshman that we had at number four that clinched the match for us in the round of 16. And, you know, I think even if he had maybe won his practice match against that senior that was number two, I've got too much data for me to maybe put the freshman above the senior, because the senior has played hundreds of matches and I know exactly how he's probably going to handle certain situations. You never know that about a first-year player. So in that sense, they're playing each other, but probably not to decide who plays in which spot. When you get down to number six, though, because that's you're either in or you're out, we're not a sport where maybe in the middle of the match, if the number six guy's not doing well, you can kind of sub someone else in. We're not like basketball. If someone's having a bad day, you just sub a new guy in. You're either in or you're out. So there are definitely times where we'll say, all right, you two go play. Whoever wins is starting in the match the next day. So it really is just a combination of everything, how they're doing in practice, how they do against each other, how they're doing against other teams.
When you're putting together the game day roster, like your matchups, is that something you have to do 24 hours in advance? Say, here are the six guys that will be, and this is, you know, player X will be one, player Y will be two, or is that something that you can scratch it out right before you're about to start?
We call it exchanging lineups. We exchange lineups about 45 minutes before the match. Okay. There are some rules around how you can move people. You're not allowed to match up. So if I think my guy that normally plays number three is great against their number one, I can't move him.
Okay, that was kind of my next question.
Yeah, so you can only move people one spot per match. So and what I mean by that is if we play a team on Saturday and he plays number three, the only place he could go if we played on Sunday or even the following week would be to number four, number two.
Okay.
And you do have to technically play in order of strength, and there is a protest. You can play a match under protest, and then it goes to a committee, and if they think you played an incorrect lineup, then you would lose the match. So I think for the most part in Division III, coaches are pretty good at kind of being fair. I do think there might be – I think Division I, you might have to submit something a day in advance. Division I, obviously, people's jobs are more on the line with wins and losses than maybe ours. So I think there's more trying to kind of game the system a little bit. But there are some things in place that kind of keep us from really trying to move guys around too much.
So for you, what was your on-ramp to tennis?
Oh, I started young. My dad was a college tennis coach, actually. He was a community college, junior college coach. And so I picked it up. The players were always around the house going to his tennis camp and going to practices and things like that. So I started playing when I was four. And you know, played other sports, but, you know, tennis was always probably the sport I was best at and, you know, just stuck with it throughout. And that's how I got started, though, is just kind of around the house and with my dad coaching.
Aside from the obvious family connection, what was it about tennis that you really enjoyed, like in the moment of playing? What is it about the game you think that first really resonated with you?
Yeah, there's a couple things. The nice thing about tennis is you're always playing. I struggled with baseball because, you know, the ball doesn't get hit to you all the time. I mean, you get to go up to bat and then you kind of are out in the field and waiting for it to be hit to you. So like I struggle with that. So I think when you start with tennis, it can be hard to go to some sports where you're not always in the action. Even sometimes kind of sitting out can be difficult because in tennis, again, you play or you're not playing. You're not really ever having to wait. I think that the other big part for me with tennis is that it is this kind of 1v1 or even in doubles 2v2. There's no one else to blame. And I love team tennis way more than I love individual tennis. I was always much better at team tennis than I was kind of the junior circuit because I like playing for my teammates. But still within the sport, there's no one else to blame or the other player doesn't really have an excuse. You know, if I beat you, then I, at least on that day, was better than you. And there's really no argument behind that. So I think I really like just the competitive nature of tennis, of like just 1v1 going out there and we're going to decide who is the best that day.
Did your dad coach you a lot?
No, he was smart enough to know that can ruin ruin a parent-child relationship. I know we see that at the pro level a lot where there's a parent that coaches the child, but what we don't see is a lot of the relationships that it can ruin, or maybe even ruin the sport for a child. So no, he really didn't coach me much, but he's always been, and he got out of coaching when I was about 10, but he's always been a great listener for me in this profession because he did go through it and he's been able to provide a ton of advice for me. And even though it's a long time ago that he coached and the sport is very different and recruiting is very different. And again, he was community college and I'm Division III liberal arts college. It's very, very different, but the basics of coaching are the same. And so he's always been able to help me as I've navigated this profession.
As you were playing, where was your game the strongest? Like if you were scouting yourself, what goes on the whiteboard?
I was always a better doubles player than I was singles player. I think I just liked it. Again, I do like the team aspect. I played basketball in high school. I loved soccer growing up. So I really do like team sports. And so doubles is a little bit like a team sport. Yeah, you know, I enjoy being at net. I liked volleys. I wasn't one of these guys that was going to sit at the baseline and play 100-shot rallies. I wanted to attack and finish the point. So I guess if you were scouting against me, you'd try to get to my back end. You'd try to keep me from coming into net is probably what you do to beat me.
Time for a break. We will have more with Jason Box in just a few moments. But right now, I want to tell you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio Studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles. And finally, take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic and HR-V from Honda. The 2025 Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com best value brand. Now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with Swarthmore College head men's tennis coach Jason Box. You played in college.
University of the South.
Swanee. Is it Swanee, the University of the South?
Yeah, it's like, more commonly known as Swanee. It's technically the University of the South
okay.
in Tennessee. And again, Division III liberal arts college and had a great experience there.
And as an aside, did you majored in anthropology?
Yeah, I know. typical liberal arts major. You know, I got to school. I was like, well, what do I want to do? That school didn't had economics. It didn't have business. But I was like, I don't know. I thought maybe history or something like that. I'm not a great student in general and took an anthropology class. Well, this seems pretty interesting. Let me keep going with that. You know, I don't know what you do with an anthropology degree. I do think it helps in coaching because, you know, in anthropology, you study all different cultures. And certainly in the sport of tennis, I have to interact with people from all over the world and all over the country and coming from very different backgrounds. So I'd like to say that it helped me become a better coach or prepared me for coaching, I guess.
During your college career, what are some of your favorite memories? Are they moments playing or are they more being part of the team and stuff like that and hanging out and, you know?
Yeah. You know, I've got a pretty bad memory. I there are maybe a few wins here and there. And we were good. We were like a top 25 team, but I played number one doubles a couple years, but I didn't make it to the NCAA tournament from an individual standpoint. We didn't win like a conference title. We were kind of always in the third, fourth match. So there weren't some major victories. I mean, there were certainly some against some rivals that I think my freshman year, I clinched a match. And I was talking about that a little bit earlier with our freshmen. It is a pretty awesome feeling to be the last one and to win. It's kind of like hitting the game-winning shot a little bit and having your teammates rush you. So that's pretty neat. But I know it's cliche. It's the van rides. It's the, you know, hanging out together after a win. It's we took spring break trips. That's a cool thing about spring sports is we get to take spring break trips and we would go out to Los Angeles. And those are some of my greatest memories of those trips.
Did you always figure you were going to coach, like, even if it wasn't college? Like,
No, I didn't. I think I liked coaching. I helped my college coach his children in basketball. That was fun. But no, I didn't. I knew I didn't want to be a teaching pro, which is the people that are at the clubs teaching lessons all day. I knew that wasn't for me. So no, I did not think that. I spent my first year out of college at a computer company, sitting behind a desk, and was just like, this can't be the next 50 years of my, you know, 40 years of my life. And I called up my college coach and said, I miss competing. I've always been a very competitive person. So I missed competing. I missed the college atmosphere, the college life, the just being on campus in the community. And I was like, what do I do? And he happened to be at the NCAA tournament with one of his players. And Mike Mullen, the legendary coach at Swarthmore that I took over for, was also there. And Coach Mullen was going on sabbatical and needed like an assistant coach and someone to fill in for a year. And my college coach said, this is a good opportunity. You should go take it. And that's how I got started in coaching, was as the assistant back in 2007 at Swarthmore.
But you were the assistant, but you were basically running things while he's on sabbatical, right? Or no?
Right. He did the reverse. He actually was there in the fall, and then during our main season, he went on sabbatical. So yeah, I had to kind of learn as
so
much.
So you were
as,
a head coach, yeah. Maybe not by title, but
yeah, I was in charge. I was probably didn't know. I'd almost be scared to look back if it was all filmed and see what what stupid things I did now that I've been doing this for a lot longer.
Did that seem nuts to you to be, what, a year, 18 months out of college, and but you're basically de facto head coach?
Well, I don't know if I felt like it was nuts. I do remember one of the story I like to tell is, we're playing these teams. Some of these teams I didn't know. We didn't play a lot of Northeast teams when I was in college. We definitely played Swarthmore, so I knew Swarthmore. But we were playing Bates College and out of Maine. And something I would do is I'd look up the opposing coach and be like, well, I'm a rookie. Who's got the coaching advantage in this match? And I looked it up, and Coach Gastingay had just coached the singles national champion maybe the year or two before that. He'd been a multiple-time All-American. He trained with Yvonne Lindell. Probably some of your listeners might know Yvonne. Some of my players don't know Yvonne Lindell. But, this great professional champion, he trained with him and learned a ton under him. I said, I am out of my league here. This guy is going to coach me in circles. And he really did. I mean, just the way that he went about coaching that match. And so I think that was a moment where that kind of hit me that, yeah, there are people that are – I am new to this. And the interesting thing was Coach Gastingay, we were talking during that match after they beat us, and he said, I've got an assistant position coming open, and if you're looking for something, let me know. And then I ended up going to Bates after my 1 year at Swarthmore and being his assistant, which I learned a ton and am extremely appreciative of to go learn under someone like that. But yeah, I mean, I made some mistakes that first year at Swarthmore that I definitely learned from.
How does it work when the coach is on sabbatical? Like, were you able to reach out to him and say, hey, X, no. Y, and Z, or this was, no. Here you go, kid, I'll be back.
Yeah, like, and this was 07, so we had cell phones, obviously, but I don't think, we certainly didn't have smartphones, and he was off in another country doing research, and he just kind of said, look, here's what I want you to do from a recruiting standpoint. Here's what I want you to do in terms of scheduling for next year, the matches. And, he helped me certainly in the fall. But once he left in the fall, I was certainly leaning on other coaches in the department, the athletic director in the department. I a lot of people helped me through that year for sure.
Did you realize in that experience that coaching was –
yeah,
where you wanted to be?
Like, yeah, I was like, this doesn't get any better. I'm hanging out with college guys. We're playing tennis. We're playing matches. And I wasn't having to do everything that a head coach has to do, obviously. But I was like, what beats this? This is fantastic. It was just a ton of fun. And yeah, the more in depth you go, the more it feels like work. But still, that hasn't changed. The going to practice and spending time with the players and going to these matches with the team, and certainly when you win a big match, the celebration and just the feeling of that as a group, I'm sure you get it in some other jobs, but I love it.
So you mentioned a couple of years at Bates as an assistant coach, and you talk about how much you learned. What would you say is the biggest thing you learned during that experience about being a collegiate coach?
I really think how to run practice, how to organize practices, how to develop players. That was just a big part of what Coach Gastingay did. We Bates is in the NESCAC, which has some of the best tennis programs in the country. And so we weren't getting quite the level of players that those schools were getting, but we had to develop the talent that we did get. And so I just really learned about how focused a practice and how much planning that needed to go into a practice. You don't see that certainly when you're a player. And we only had a few, handful of practices as an assistant in that fall at Swarthmore. And so to see, hey, we're spending an hour every day planning practice and it being very specific to players or what we need at the time. I think the other part of it was I did get to see the highest level of Division III tennis when I was an assistant there. Our doubles team won the national title and our singles player made a finals run. But also, again, playing in that conference at the time, it was the best tennis conference in the country. So every weekend we're just playing really, really good teams. And so understanding that level, because I again wasn't at that level of player. It was really eye opening for me.
So then after a couple of years, you become a head coach at Lake Forest, right?
Right.
How much did the experience at Swarthmore as that, you know, interim head coach help you when you had now a program to work with?
Probably not much, honestly, because once you become a head coach, there's all these things that you do that you probably don't do as an assistant. I mean, I guess it depends on your head coach and what they let you do. It was a totally different level of school, and the recruiting was very different. So again, I mentioned Swarthmore's got such a reputation that a lot of kids, they want to come play for you. You just have to figure out, are they the right fit? Even with Bates, even though it's not quite the level of academics that Swarthmore is, it's still an amazing school that a lot of students want to go to. So you're kind of still to a certain level picking and choosing who do you want on your team. And at Lake Forest, it was a little bit more of a regional school, and so the recruiting was significantly harder there. And so trying to figure that out was harder. I was an assistant for both the men and the women at Bates, but obviously being the head coach for men and women, they played their women's season in the fall, so that was very different, and their men's season in the spring. So that was something I wasn't used to. So there was definitely some challenges there.
And then Millsaps after that,
right,
which took you to you coming to Swarthmore.
Right.
When do you feel – so I think 2011 Millsaps, and then you come to Swarthmore in 2018. When along this run – do you feel like you started to hit your stride as a head coach? And I don't mean necessarily success. I just mean what it takes. You understand the assignment. You know what goes into it. You know how to have success. Like, how long did it take you to really, you know, find your way?
Probably about 3 or 4 years into that Millsaps tenure. You kind of start to figure out your school and how to make things work at that school. You start to get, you know, a whole team that's your players. That was certainly a first for me. Again, didn't recruit the players at Swarthmore, didn't really recruit the players. I was only at Bates for 2 years. And so it was, everyone kind of is buying into what you are, the tone that you're setting. So I would say 3 or 4 years into that time at Millsaps. And then you kind of have to learn it again when you go to a new school. When I came to Swarthmore, probably we were interrupted with COVID, but I certainly during those first couple of years at Swarthmore, I knew Swarthmore and I knew a whole lot more about the profession, certainly, but you're talking about a different level player, different academic standards. You're having to figure out what can I put on my stamp on this team, but also understand that things are different here, so I can't do everything the same. So yeah, I think it always takes a couple years of being at a school.
So what's the door that brings you back? What's the door that opens that brings you back to Swarthmore after? Because you were coaching the men and women at Millsaps, right?
I'd always kept my eye on Swarthmore. I mean, I knew coaches here and was rooting for other teams. And again, if you want to win at the highest level in Division III tennis, you do need to be at one of these pretty strong academic schools. And there's only so many of those, and they don't come open very often. I would like to have coaching two teams is certainly more challenging than coaching one team. So I was hoping to eventually only have to coach one team. I knew Coach Mullen was getting close to retirement. And so it was just, I knew that the opportunity was going to come open, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to take it or wanted to go for it. I still had a good relationship with Coach Loomis, who's our women's coach at Swarthmore. He was there when I was an assistant, and we'd even played each other when I was our women's teams had played each other when I was at Millsaps, and we'd been on some committees together and all that kind of stuff. And you know, he reached out, he said, look, you know, I think I really want you to apply. And that meant a lot to me. And so I applied, and again, competitive person, once you decide that you're going to do something, it's like, okay, now I want to win this thing and try to get the job. So that was, it just seemed like the right time. We'd done probably about as well as we could at Millsaps. We had both teams nationally ranked for the first time in forever. We'd had a woman become All-American, a men's doubles team make the NCAA tournament, which was first time in maybe, you know, 20, 30 years, something like that. So I felt like we'd probably done as best we could there.
You mentioned, or we've kind of talked about, you know, team success and then at the college level and then individual success. Like, you guys as a team went to the Elite Eight, but I mentioned you also had individual players that went to the national finals, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work from the standpoint of, is it the success you have with the team? is accumulated as an individual, and then those individuals, if they've won enough matches as part of the team, they get to compete on the individual track at the tournament?
That's probably one of the hardest things for us to explain in college tennis, and Division I does it a little bit differently now. No, your team success doesn't necessarily impact your top players and their ability to make the NCAA tournament. So the way the team makes the NCAA tournament, just like you would think about in any other sport, you've got some automatic qualifiers who win their conference tournament, which is what we did. And then you have some at-larges, top-ranked teams that maybe didn't win their conference. So that, and then, again, the tournament structure is very similar to like a March Madness or something like that. Because we're an individual sport, just traditionally you've got your singles champion and your doubles champion. So in Division III, 16 doubles teams are selected to go to the NCAA tournament, and 32 singles players are selected to go to the NCAA tournament. I'm trying to think of how to not make it too deep. But if you're one of the top players in your region, you're going to make it in singles and in doubles. So the better teams you play, the better schedule where you can go get wins against other top players. So we play a lot of teams kind of out of our region. We either travel a lot or we bring other teams in to play because we're just one of the better teams in the region. So we need to go find not only teams but also players to play against. So our number one guy this year had a phenomenal season. I believe he was 17-0 in the regular season at number one. You know, that's going to pretty much lock you down, especially with as competitive a schedule as we played. Our doubles team was a little bit more on the bubble. They played a really competitive schedule, and again, because we as a team played a competitive schedule, they lost a decent amount, but they were losing to all good teams. So it's kind of one of those, well, they've got some good wins, and then they've got a bunch of losses, but all their losses are to other teams that are in the tournament. So they're pretty good. And our doubles team, they've had a great history. They've been very successful over the last 3 years. So maybe some of that played a role in them making it. I think one of the cool things for us this year, because our number one player, he was a senior and has had an amazing career.
And who was that?
That's Michael Melnikov. I think he's finished top 10 in the country in singles all 4 years. He was Centennial Conference Player of the Year for 4 years. So I think we knew he was going to make the tournament. Making the tournament for him wasn't that big of a deal. But our number two player, a guy named Max Lindstrom, another senior that had kind of played in the shadow of Mike for 4 years. He's been a huge part of our success, an unbelievable young man. But he never made the NCAA tournament because it's really hard when you play in the number two spot. You really need to play in the number one spot to make the tournament. He was able to be selected, which was really cool and super happy for him because he'd had such a good year at the number two spot. Yes, he'd taken some losses, but those were to good players, and he'd beaten some very good players that, you know, he made the tournament over a lot of number ones from good programs.
We need another break. We will have more with Swarthmore's Jason Box coming up. But right now, I want to remind you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio Studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles. And finally, take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic and HR-V from Honda. The 2025 Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com best value brand. Now let's get back on One-on-One with Matt Leon to our conversation with Jason Box, head men's tennis coach at Swarthmore College. Singles doubles, from your standpoint when you're putting a team together, are the skill sets the same? Like if a player, just because they are very good in singles, does it not necessarily translate to doubles? Like is there a unique skill set that you need? And I'm sure it's not universal, but to have success playing doubles.
Well, if you can serve really well and you can return really well, you're going to be good at both. I mean, you got pro players that are, you know, 6'8" and just serve for the most part, and they're making a good living because they can just serve so well. I think if you're a player that's really, really consistent from the baseline, that might not translate to doubles because the rallies aren't as long. It's not about being able to hit the ball from the baseline a ton. So really what I'm looking for in doubles, do you serve well, do you return well, and can you play the net well? So can you be comfortable up at net and be good at volleys, be good at overheads? It helps to be big and athletic. So, yeah, some of our guys that did not – they're technically our six – they're in our top six singles players, so that you could say they're one of our six best tennis players, but just their skill set in singles – or their skill set to be a really good tennis player does not translate great to doubles. Maybe they don't serve as hard. Maybe they're not as confident at net. So yeah, we had three guys that played doubles only, and a lot of that is because they serve well and can be really aggressive up at net.
Do you recruit specifically some players that only for doubles? Like, I think your skill set, maybe beyond if they've had success with that at the high school or club level, but like, you just think, you know, your skill set, if we get you with the right person, I think this is where you're gonna thrive.
It's probably not like some other sports where we really need a catcher or we really need a goalie. If we really need to improve in doubles, we're not necessarily going out and looking specifically for a doubles player. But one example I like to give is, we were a very senior-heavy team. Mike played doubles with a guy named Utham Kaduri, and Utham, coming out of high school, did not have a great singles ranking. Again, very good, but maybe just by the singles, maybe we would have said, we're not sure. Maybe he's not quite at the level we want to add to our team. But he'd been an excellent doubles player in high school. We had been struggling in doubles. And so I said, all right, I knew he'd be a great teammate and a great leader because of the high school team he played on. He'd had great success in doubles, very athletic. And I was just like, this is definitely someone we need to add. I think he's going to help us in doubles. And then maybe his singles will work out. He didn't play a ton of singles, not partly because of him. I think partly just because we recruited better and got better players. But he had an unbelievable doubles career, finishing second. They finished second their freshman year. They finished fourth their junior year and made the NCAA tournament all 4 years. And Utham was a three-time doubles All-American. So that's a great example of us taking someone because they were not for doubles only, but because of their strength in doubles.
We talked about the action going on simultaneously during one of your matches. How much of an impact do you feel you have on match day, or is the cake baked and it's up to the players to perform, or are there things that you do, you know, be it talking to the kids, like do you feel like you can move the needle at all on match day?
It's a great question. I mean, you probably need to phone a couple of our players to get the answer on that. I think what's unique for us is you've got six different singles players out there that are dealing with, you know, six different matches. It's there are different things going on, so there's different strategy for each one of them. They have their own strengths. Their opponent has their own strengths and weaknesses. I do think coaching can have a major impact. Yeah, I do. Whether that's tactical, whether that's emotional. I mean, our sport is, you have a lot of time to just be in your own head. It's not lonely in the sense that I think they describe pro tennis as very lonely, and you can see that someone's out there in the middle of a big crowd and it's just them. They have allowed coaching a little bit more in pro tennis now, but I think having that support system, a coach there to maybe just let you vent, to cheer you on. So I do think that we have a big impact. But in terms of if you think about a football coach that's calling the plays, or basketball coach, they're calling play, they're having major impact on matches. On games. I don't think we're having quite that level of impact in terms, you know, we don't call plays necessarily. We might talk strategy, but we're not going to be, I think Monday morning, people are going to be second guessing what we said. I do think we control the lineup. And so the more talent you have, the harder that lineup gets to figure out who should be playing where, and getting doubles lineup right, getting the singles lineup right. That is all on the coaching staff, and that is where you can really screw it up.
With the doubles pairings, are they set? I don't mean set in stone, like, but once you've paired up a couple of players and they've started to play together as doubles, do you like to keep them together, or is there mixing and matching that goes on? Can it get stale? A couple of guys have been working together and, you know, it's not bad, but it's just not quite what it may be used to. Let's try something different. Like, how often are you moving the parts around when it comes to your doubles matches?
So I mentioned, you know, the coach and the lineup, how long you stick with something that might not be going well. That could be the number six singles player that might be struggling, and you got the number seven guy sitting there. How long do I wait to put that seven guy in? Maybe it's someone that's playing higher in the lineup, maybe the three spot, and they're really struggling. Well, when do we move them down and make it a little bit easier? Same thing with doubles. If you're not winning, if you're not playing at the level that we think we need, then when do we kind of pull the cord on it and go to something new? we were quite good at doubles this year, so we stuck with the three teams all year, and they're the same three teams that played last year. We had we had the luxury of having a lot of guys return, and you know, we definitely tried different pairings and thought about splitting some of those guys up, but they just weren't as good as what we saw from last year. So we went with it, and it worked. Certainly, the longer you can keep a pair together, they're probably going to improve. But we're kind of constantly trying things, and sometimes we might throw two guys together at practice, and you're just trying to see if there's a little bit of a spark. And it's like, oh, well, I didn't necessarily think those two would play like that, but oh, wow, they have good chemistry, or they complement, their games complement each other well. So we'll move on. I mean, that it's a long season, but it's also a short season. You can only let kind of people go for a certain period of time before you have to try something new.
On a match day, how do you approach it just simply from a logistical standpoint? Because when you've got all this action going on at the same time, and I don't know what's allowed by rules and stuff like that, like, are you just kind of walking from court to court? Do you set up kind of at a spot where you feel like you can see all the action, maybe not perfectly, but you can get a general idea? And then, you know, or are there certain matches that you know, all right, there's a good chance that number four is going to be the pressure point. Like, sure, that's going to be where the bread's going to be made, and let me really focus on that. How do you approach it?
Differently, kind of all the time. Some of it depends on what you've got from a coaching staff standpoint. So there have been times in my career where I was the only coach. So, you're one coach trying to coach six. Some people are just going to have to either do it on their own, or they're not going to get as much attention, or maybe once they're winning, you don't go back. Or if they're losing a lot, you say, well, I can't save you. I've been lucky enough to have, over the last few years, some great assistant coaches. A lot of times, a number of them just volunteering their time and are really into it. So I'm appreciative. But you know, they can't make every match, maybe, or something like that. And some of it, I should say, also depends on the facility that we're playing in. I think that's another unique thing about college tennis. Yeah, the tennis court is the same, but you know, for the most part, every gym is the same. Every baseball field is kind of the same. The dimensions might be different, but from a coaching standpoint, it's about the same. For us, all these colleges have completely different – they can have very different facilities. They might still have six courts, but the layout is different, and how much you can see is different. And, I think I try to stick on a couple of courts, and then we put each assistant coach on a couple of courts. Kind of everyone deals with two courts. I think as the head coach, I am kind of paying attention to all the matches that are going on. And if I need to go, and maybe I don't even tell the player, but I tell the coach something, I'm worrying about the guys that aren't playing and are they doing the right things. If we're playing indoors, which means we don't play six matches at the same time because you don't have six, most places don't have six indoor courts. I'm worried about making sure that the guy that's next is ready to go and getting ready to play. And so you're worrying about a lot of stuff as a head coach, but yeah, I think depending on your coaches and the facility, at the beginning of the match, we'll have an idea. We'll say, well, why don't you go work with these two? I'll go these two. And we'll even sometimes maybe have an idea. We think it's going to come down to maybe this spot or that spot. Sometimes with the facility, you can't even see some of the other courts. And so you really do just have to depend on your assistant coaches. The other thing that's kind of cool about our sport, and maybe it happens in other sports, is that you're allowed to designate – there's allowed to be three total coaches. You can designate a player to be a coach. And so sometimes we'll put those older players that have had some experience and we'll put them out there. And we'll ask a player that is playing, do you want one of us or do you want like the player to go sit on your court? And so it is kind of different a lot.
I think you mentioned earlier you guys were very senior heavy this year. And it's obviously a senior class that has had an incredible run of success.
Yep.
So looking ahead now to next year, it's obviously going to be different. Mm-hmm. Is your approach different as a head coach? Because it sounds like a lot of this, you mentioned the doubles guys that played the last two. Like, there was a lot of this stuff where you had guys in position that really understood the assignment, had competed at this level, had succeeded at this level. The team had succeeded. Are you looking at next season? I don't like not starting over, but that it's going to be different. And will your approach be different at all?
I think every year the approach is a little different based on who's on the team and how things went the previous year. And I think the thing that's most important for us is that the culture stays the same. When we came out of COVID, we kind of had to rebuild the culture. That was kind of interrupted by COVID. I'm a very different coach than Coach Mullen. who I took over for. And so I was in the process of trying to kind of move it in the direction that I wanted it. And then, you know, we were interrupted for about 2 years. And so we really did just kind of start from scratch. And I feel really good about where the team culture is and the program culture. And I know you hear that from all the coaches that talk about culture. But as long as the culture stays intact, the talent, I don't want to say can be replaced, because you can't replace players. They bring not only their level of play, but they bring their personality. So you can't replace them. But as long as the culture stays intact, the standards stay the same, and every player has the opportunity to live up to those standards. So I'm not worried about that. I've loved my end of season conversations with our returning players. They were extremely close with the seniors. They are going to miss them. They really did love them, and it was a group of 17 players that was extremely close. But you can tell that these young players are ready for their opportunity. And I think they also feel like they have a ton to prove, that it's not just, hey, we were good because of those seniors. We're good because of all of us, and now it's their time to shine. So there will be new challenges. I am really excited. I mean, there is some comfort in going, you know, we were talking about the doubles teams. We're like, hey, well, we kind of know our doubles teams. But I'm also, part of the fun of this job is figuring out what's the recipe for success. And we were able to find it, and maybe we didn't have to deal with as many ingredients this past year because we had so many known quantities. But next year, there are more unknowns. But I also feel very confident in the group that's returning, the new players. They are excited, hungry, and they're talented. Again, we are a much more talented team than when those six seniors came in 4 years ago. We're much deeper, much, much more talented. So the talent is, I don't think, going to be a major drop-off in any way. I think that can kind of keep replenishing itself. It's our focus just has to be keeping the culture the same.
Final question, favorite part of the job?
You should have let me know. The final question is the hardest. I think the competition, the match day is so much fun. And to see players fight through whatever they're dealing with, maybe they had a really tough week at school, maybe they've got stuff going on in their life, maybe it was just getting over the hump in a specific match. I will say one of my greatest memories from this year was, I mentioned Max Lindstrom, who was this number two player who worked his tail off, had done everything, again, coach's dream, and he finally made it to the NCAA tournament for singles. And if you win the first round there, that's one way to become an All-American. All-American, you kind of, it separates you from those are the best players in program history. And, you know, he won that match. And you know, you can never take the All-American away from him. I mean, I can't imagine another job that feels that way, you know, after that match. Just so happy for him, because I had watched the 4 years of commitment and work. And then certainly when we won in the round of 16, just to see the excitement on the players' faces, and we went to dinner as a team afterwards, and just when you put in a ton of hard work to see success in young people, it's very rewarding, and it's a lot of fun. It's really cool.
Jason Box, thanks so much for coming in. This was great.
Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
And that will do it for this edition of 101 with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank Swarthmore College head men's tennis coach Jason Box for coming in studio and being our guest this week. Now, if you like this show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at 101pod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.